Hey there, ACRackers. I want to tell you about a CME conference that I will be speaking at in the new year from February 28th to March 7th, 2026. It is an amazing conference. It is the Holiday Seminars Conference in Maui at the Hyatt Regency Maui Resort and Spa. I have been there before. I've spoken at this before, and it is incredible. The family, the Smith family that puts this on, they really do an incredible job. It's going to be some amazing speakers. It's a beautiful hotel and an opportunity to really enjoy Hawaii and Maui, and especially at a time when Maui is trying to recover from the wildfires. They're really going all out to try to make the tourist experience an amazing one. So I think this is a great year to come, and the conference is going to be incredible. You're going to hear from amazing speakers who are going to go over really, really high-yield topics. I highly, highly recommend signing up for this. You can go to holidayseminars.com and click on the Maui link, and you can register there. You can use CME money. It is going to be amazing. So I hope I will get a chance to see you there. It'll be a ton of fun.
In cybersecurity, speed is survival. SOC Radar is your early warning system, monitoring external threats to your company to spot risks before breaches. SOC Radar delivers proactive threat intelligence with actionable insights for holistic exposure management across attack surfaces, dark web, and brand protection. With automated detection, triage, and investigation, SOC Radar is your business's frontline defense. Start your free trial at socradar.io/podcast. That's socradar.io/podcast. Don't wait.
We've all done it. Stock our fridge with leafy greens and good intentions, only to have our future self sacrifice quality nutrition for the convenience of takeout. Keep your body and mind nourished all day with a whole body meal shake from Kachava. It's got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. But the best part? It actually tastes delicious. With 6 indulgent flavors to choose from, it's easy to make a superfood-packed shake. From chocolate, vanilla, and chai to matcha, coconut acai, and strawberry, you've got endless ways to personalize your Kachava. Whether you prefer it straight up or enjoy adding fruit, peanut butter, nut milk, or even iced coffee, with every 2 scoops of Kachava, you're getting 85-plus superfoods, nutrients, and plant-based ingredients. Shop now through December 2nd to get 30% off your first purchase of 2 or more bags with code FITNESS at Kachava.com. That's 30% off for a limited time at kachava.com, code FITNESS.
Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I am excited to be able to play for you today the audio of our live episode from the Anesthesiology Annual Meeting in San Antonio, Texas. So without further ado, here is the recording.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to an ACRAC podcast. We are live at Anesthesiology 2025 here in San Antonio, Texas. This recording will be released both on the ACRAC feed and on the ASA Centraline podcast feed. So you'll be able to find it there in the weeks and months to come. I'm very excited to be here and really grateful to all of you for coming to listen. We are going to have an exciting talk today. I've got with me Dr. Joyce Warr. Dr. Warr was a cardiac anesthesiologist, practiced at University of Michigan for 20 plus years, and then transitioned into the patient safety space where she really made a name for herself in patient safety. She published a paper that was called one of the best papers of the decade in the 2010s on patient safety in the cardiac ORs. And she continues, even though she's mostly retired from practice, to speak and advocate for patient safety. She's giving the Severinghouse lecture on Tuesday, talking about cognitive errors, why they happen, and how we can maybe start to think about preventing them. And that's what we're going to talk about today. I'm thrilled to have her here. Dr. Warr, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here, and thank you all for coming as well.
So the structure will be that we'll chat for about 25, 30 minutes, and then we will open it up to audience Q&A. So, Joyce, let me start by asking you, how did you get interested in cognitive error prevention?
So in 2002, I left University of Michigan because my husband, who's here today, left cardiology and moved to Minneapolis to start medical devices. So I took a little bit of a sabbatical, and during that time, not working, you know, at the university hospital, I did go back to Minnesota, but a little bit of time, and was asked to chair the SCA, Society of Cardiovascular Anesthesiologists Foundation. And they had a major project that they were wanting to kick off with Peter Pronovost, looking at patient safety in the cardiac operating rooms. And that was where I started. And I started reading all the books, James Reason, Human Error, all the James Reason books, and then branching out into some of the other books, not written by anesthesiologists, but written by cognitive psychologists. Here's how we think. Here's how errors arise. And I was amazed at the information that's available out there that most people do not have. We do not know why we make errors.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of wild to think about. In our specialty, errors can be the difference between life and death, and we don't really have a great feel for how they happen or how to prevent them. So you've taken an interest in this. Let's talk about the difference between System 1 and System 2 thinking. Now, some people may have read Thinking Fast and Slow, but for those who haven't, maybe just give us an idea of what is System 1, what is System 2, and how do they differ?
Right. And of course, we all know that we work on two different planes, the unconscious and the conscious. We tie our shoes without any conscious attention. But Kahneman and his partner, Amos Tversky, who he always gives equal credit to, unfortunately, Dr. Tversky died quite young of a malignant melanoma, so we'll just talk about Kahneman. But he really put it into this System 1 and System 2, and he acknowledged they're not really different systems, but it's a useful construct. So System 1, fast, automatic, effortless, subconscious, is what lets you drive a car at 70 miles an hour on a busy freeway, while your conscious, deliberative, deductive brain is trying to figure out how you're going to manage that very fragile mitral regurg patient tomorrow. And the two work pretty independently, but they're never isolated. So when you see a traffic jam up ahead, System 2 stops thinking about that patient and starts thinking about what other route can I take to get to work on time.
So System 1 is kind of the autopilot. Is that a fair way to think about it?
Right. We do not even know what System 1 is doing. We just get in the car and we drive, right? And all of that is subconscious. And I think it's just absolutely incredible, amazing, spectacular what System 1 does on an everyday basis. It's 99%. Of what we do every single day. It's how you walk is all System 1. And System 1 gets that because from the time you're tiny, you're absorbing, saving all these sights, sounds, perceptions, actions, reactions. And by the time you're just even 3 or 4 years old, you have this incredible matrix of associative memories that System 1 is using minute to minute, second to second, to assess reality, reach back into those associative memories, find a similar stored mental model, and bring it forward and says to your conscious mind, oh, here's where you are, and here's what's happening.
So does this explain why when I get in the car and it's Saturday morning and I don't have to work, and I'm supposed to be driving to my daughter's soccer game, and I realize halfway to work that I'm driving to work?
Right.
Because System 1 is doing what it thinks I'm supposed to be doing.
And you probably don't even know what you're doing. And when I talk about System 1 errors, these are errors we can't predict, we can't prevent, and very often we don't even perceive them until you're almost at work.
Right.
You didn't even perceive you were making that error.
Right. Okay. Now, is there a way to say, how do I get System 2 to stop me from doing that?
No.
No.
No, there is no way to really. You could have System 2 consciously pay attention to every action sequence you're doing, but that's really impossible. System 2 requires effort, right? It's an effortful, deductive process. And you don't have that much reserve for effort. And there are lots of competing things for effort. And in the operating room, disciplining yourself to not snap at the obnoxious surgeon also pulls from that same reserve of effort. You're physically busy. You do not have any bandwidth to bring conscious attention to every time you pick up a syringe or every time you swab an injection port. You couldn't possibly do it. You couldn't possibly do it.
Yeah, that's why we need System One.
Right.
Yeah. So let's talk about eyewitnesses. You'd think an eyewitness would be the most reliable witness, right? They saw it. They were there. Whatever we're talking about, they saw it happen. They, in court, you know, you watch a trial on TV. I mean, the eyewitness is there. They're giving testimony. But you would say eyewitnesses are not necessarily reliable. Tell me why.
Right. And we're going to come back to this because we're going to talk a little bit about tranexamic acid and bupivacaine. So when I said that System One is continually scanning what's out there and then going back in, trying to find a mental model that fits this pretty well, System One is built for speed, not for precision. And so if it grabs the wrong mental model and it doesn't quite agree with what's out here, it doesn't change the mental model to fit reality. It changes reality to fit the mental model. And so when you have two eyewitnesses who observe exactly the same event happening, each one of them, they have different associative memories. A lot are quite similar, but different enough so that then when this eyewitness's System One says, oh, here's a mental model that this one fits, and presents that as reality, it can be different than what System One does in the person standing right next to them. And we think, well, this must be new information. Sully wrote the book Illusions in 1881. This idea that our subconscious counterfeits immediate knowledge, that this is why we misperceive what's out there, because our subconscious is continually reflecting back to those mental models. And he was the first one that talked about this is why eyewitnesses are really unreliable. And then Musterberg, early 1900s at Harvard, went back to that theme, and he wrote a book on the unreliability of eyewitnesses. And in the introduction, he gives about four court cases. One of them, these are court cases, transcripts of what eyewitnesses said during the same event. The first eyewitness said it was drizzly and muddy. The second one said it was dry and dusty. So not minor little irregularities, major differences. How long was it between when that horn blew and the event occurred? One eyewitness, 10 seconds. The other one, upwards of 10 minutes. Major differences in what each one of them perceived as this is reality happening now. Considerably different.
And so how much of that is just that our memories aren't great, right? So it's hard for me to remember what happened back then. So I think it was about 10 minutes. And how much of it is that in the moment, we are actually perceiving different things?
So it's both. And certainly over time, our memories definitely degrade. So differences get, I think, greater and greater. But even at the moment, there's a powerful emotional component in it. So my husband was broadsided by a criminal trying to get away. It was a white car and a certain model. And I'm sure that if Dennis watched another broadside accident, in his mind, it may very likely the color of the car may be remembered as white because it has such an emotional context to it. And we don't even perceive that that's happening.
Yeah, and that is really wild, right? So you're saying that in the moment when a red car broadsides somebody, he may see the car as white.
Well, that's a pretty big distinction. But if it was silver, easy to see it as white. So the closer they are to alike, the easier it is for System One to make those two line up and agree. System one loves coherence. It needs a story that makes sense with everything else that's in the brain, and it will make sense of reality. Can I give an example?
Please.
So this is a study done many years ago where test subjects were shown just a brief glimpse of a schematic of a bedroom. Two rectangles denoting twin beds, a square, that's the nightstand. And on the nightstand was a pretty large old-time alarm clock with those little ringy-dingy things on it. And everybody knew that that was a bedroom. They all knew the alarm clock. When they were asked what time was on the alarm clock, some said 6, some said 8, some said 5. And when pressed, they were very confident that, yes, this was the time on the clock. There were no hands on the clock. System one does not have a mental model of a clock that doesn't have hands. So the only mental model that fits this scenario is an alarm clock with hands. So that's the perception it presented to these test subjects. And then, of course, the time of the hands, naturally, it's the time you would see when you get up. So that's just one. It sounds like a funny, interesting story, but it's real scientific evidence that what gets presented to our conscious brain as reality is just a perception of reality.
So there's the famous study where they took chest x-rays and put a gorilla in the midst of the chest, right? A little gorilla. And they showed them to radiologists, and the radiologists often didn't see the gorilla, right? And I'm imagining this must be because when they look at a chest x-ray, it's so automated for them. They have a schema of, you know, what this is, and gorilla existing in the chest is not one of the things.
Right.
And so they literally didn't see it, right?
Right.
It's not like they decide to leave it out of their report. They didn't see the gorilla.
Right. So there is another, it's a videotape, it must be 30 years old, very interesting, college students. Half of them have on white T-shirts, half have on black, and each team has a basketball, and they're passing back and forth between each other, and they're moving around each other. And your job is to count the number of passes that the white team makes. And it goes on for 20 seconds or so. Tape ends, and the announcer says the correct answer is 15 passes. But did you see the gorilla? You rewind the tape, and sure enough, at about pass 8 or 9, here comes a college student in a gorilla suit. He walks into this group passing the basketball. He turns. He looks at the camera. He waves at the camera and leaves. But he wasn't in white, and he didn't have a basketball. He was not pertinent to the task at hand in any way. Your task was to count the passes the white team makes. Your system one didn't even tell your conscious brain that that character was there. Same way with the chest x-ray. And I don't want to frighten people about, oh my God, I can't even trust what my eyes are showing me. I can't trust my system one. We don't want to be fearful of system one. But I think the more we learn about how these errors can creep up, the more, I'm not going to say the more able we are to prevent them, we can't prevent them, the more accepting we will be of those interventions that will prevent those very natural errors that our system one makes from reaching and harming a patient, so that we will refuse to hear our leadership say, when there's been a bad medication syringe swap, just try harder. How many of you have had your pharmacist say, if you just read the label, right? Just read the label. But the clock story tells us that you can't just read the label. So I'm going back to that bupivacaine.
Yeah, so tell us that. So let's talk about how this exists in our specialty. So tell us about the tranexamic acid and bupivacaine.
So I think most people know that over the past decade, we've had 12 case reports or so all around the world, certainly many here in the U.S., where a anesthesia provider doing a spinal for an ortho case or for a elective C-section, the nurse brought and put ampule of transuxamic acid and an ampule of bupivacaine on, you know, your medication tray. And in the midst of doing the spinal, anesthesiologist picked up TXA and gave it intrathecally. And most of those cases, the patient dies. And whenever we have providers, practitioners who get caught in one of those terrible syringe swaps, very, very frequently they say, but I did read the label. I'm sure I looked at the label, and I'm sure that they did. But System 1 has no mental model of you doing a spinal where you put TXA into the CSF. So when you look at the vial, it says, no, you'd never have, this doesn't match the story at all. And I think you actually see bupivacaine. You're convinced that it's bupivacaine. So when people say, try harder, even when you try to bring your conscious brain to it, System 1 is so powerful about altering your perception of reality, that's extremely difficult. Now, there's an incredibly simple solution, right? Transuxamic acid only gets supplied in a mini bag. You'd never hook a mini bag to a spinal, right? So that's such a simple solution, completely effective, so easy to do. We asked for it in Minnesota. We don't have the money. We can't afford it. Our pharmacist doesn't have enough time to do that.
Yeah, so that's such a great example. It's much like the silver and white cars, right? So those vials, they're pretty similar, right? If the tranexamic acid one came in a bright red double-sized vial and the bupivacaine was in a blue small vial, it probably wouldn't happen. But they're similar enough that you're saying it's not that you accidentally picked up one and didn't read it. You're saying that the practitioner picks it up, looks at it, and because in their mind, the only thing that should be there is bupivacaine, while they're doing a spinal, they actually see bupivacaine, and then they give it, even though it said tranexamic acid, but their mind is just not able to see that in that moment.
And how tragic for that practitioner who is highly skilled, highly intelligent. The last word you would use for them is careless. They care a great deal. But we just have to accept the fact that this is what happens and be willing to demand that we have those interventions. And I think sometimes our leadership gets away with saying we don't have the money, we can't afford it. We're sort of complicit in that because we think we can try harder. We think this is like an athletic competition where we can train and we can try harder. But System 1 doesn't allow for that. And again, I don't want us to be terrified of our System 1. So this is System 1. Been doing cardiac anesthesia for maybe 5-8 years. And we just finished urgent CABG on a patient who had had a STEMI 3 days before. Dressings are on. This cardiac surgeon has gone next door to start the next case. And I go around to manage the pleurovac, the chest tubes, and watching horror as the pleurovac literally fills with blood in the space of about 2 seconds. System 1. Rocky, don't break down the pump. We're going back on bypass. Gina, get your table up here right now. Deb, call the blood bank. Tell them to stay 10 units ahead. I run next door. I say, Mike, you've got to come now. He's exsanguinated into the chest tube. We've got to get on bypass or he's dead. Mike looks at me and comes. By the time he gets back in the room, Deb already had a new gown and gloves open and ready for him. The surgical resident had the drapes off, splashed betadine on the chest, and was snipping the sternal wires. Rocky had his pump up. Gina had her table up, and we were back on bypass in about 5 minutes. And the patient walked out of the hospital neurologically intact 10 days later. That scenario would never have happened in System 2. you could never have gotten on bypass. We only managed that because each of us had done those things hundreds of times previously. We didn't have to think about how to tie our shoes. Mike Thiebe has put in so many purse strings, so many arterial cannula. Rocky's gone back on pump again and again and again. And we did it without thinking. So system one is capable of errors, but it is also capable of what James Reason calls heroic rescues. So we do not want to hobble system one. We don't want to live in fear of it. We don't want to try to watch it all the time. Let's just put the barriers in place that we know are effective at capturing those inadvertent errors. And let's protect not just ourselves, but our fellow practitioners from being devastated. And people have committed suicide over having one of these errors. Even when we had barriers we could have used to prevent that from happening.
Yeah. So it seems to me that what you're saying and what makes a lot of sense is we need system one. We don't want to say, let's get rid of it. We need it for those heroic rescues. But we want to set things up so that system one can be successful. And so the things you talked about, in other words, using a mini bag for tranexamic acid, making a connection so that the bupivacaine pump cannot be hooked up to the IV would be another one, right? So it can only be hooked up to the epidural. Right. That
small bore connectors, unique small bore connectors.
So would we call these forcing functions? Is that what that term means?
They would be. So certainly pin indexing, antihypoxia valves. When I started anesthesia, you could forget to turn the oxygen on. We didn't have pulse oximetry. We didn't have FiO2. You could turn nitrous and an anesthetic gas on and have no clue that you had just done that. They were right next to each other. They looked very similar. So our cockpit on the right is a model of safety and forcing functions. We have all those things on the right in our anesthesia workstation that prevent errors we might make, like turning up the nitrous instead of the oxygen. We've prevented that from ever happening. Computerization, automation, antihypoxia valves. Our left side, the medication administration side, looks exactly the way it did when I was a resident in 1981. We have things we can do. Pre-filled syringes, great FMEA, failure modes and effects analysis of everything that can go wrong from starting preparation of a medication to administering it. 68 possible failure nodes. If you have pre-filled syringes, you eliminate 20 of those error nodes. Do you guys all have pre-filled? Every syringe in your medication tray is pre-filled? We have maybe one or two epinephrine, ephedrine, you know, some of the code things, but they won't give us all of those others. And they won't give us tranexamic acid in a mini bag.
In a mini bag.
Stay with us. We'll be right back. Hey, folks. Fall always feels like a reset. Between back to school, busier routines, and shorter days, finding time to cook can be tough. That's why I love Factor. Their chef-prepped, dietitian-approved meals make it easy to stay on track and enjoy something comforting and delicious no matter how hectic the season gets. My kids think Factor tastes like restaurant food, and it really does. Even my two younger daughters, who are very picky eaters, are loving every meal we get from Factor. Some favorites are the chicken tikka masala and premium proteins like salmon and shrimp that come at no extra cost. And with 65 different meal options, you've got GLP-1 friendly meals packed with protein and healthy fats and savory global flavors like the new Asian and inspired meals influenced by China, Thailand, and more. 97% of customers say Factor helped them live a healthier life, and the amazing thing is that it's not just healthy, but super fast and incredibly tasty. I wouldn't have believed it until I tried it. Get Factor if you want all the flavor and none of the fuss. Get started at factormeals.com/ACRAC50OFF and use code ACRAC50OFF to get 50% off your first box plus free breakfast for a year. That's code ACCRAC50OFF at factormeals.com/ACRAC50OFF to get 50% off plus free breakfast for an entire year. Hey folks, the holidays are almost here, and if you still have names on your list, don't panic. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. You'll discover presents that feel meaningful and personal, never rushed or last minute. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the United States. Many are crafted by independent artists and small businesses, so every gift feels special and thoughtfully chosen. I found these foldable cat toys that I got for my kids, and they loved them. They were able to put them together, and they each wanted one in their rooms, and my wife and I loved that we were helping an independently owned small business. Uncommon Goods has something for everyone. Check it out, and you'll find unforgettable gifts that are anything but ordinary. And with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back a dollar to a nonprofit of your choice. They've donated more than $3.1 million to date. So shop early, have fun, and cross some names off your list today. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/ACRAC. That's uncommongoods.com/ACCRAC for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary. Hey folks, you know what can make a real difference in your quality of life at work? Comfortable scrubs. And not just any scrubs, but Fig scrubs. They're made for awesome humans and I think can truly make a difference for healthcare workers. These are scrubs that have our needs in mind. They're durable, antimicrobial, and super comfortable, which matters when you're 10 hours into your shift. I love my Figs, and let me tell you, my wife, a pediatrician, loves hers too. She wears them to work every day, as do many of the doctors and nurses I work with. It doesn't matter if you're a dentist, a nurse practitioner, an anesthesiologist like me, or even a medical student starting out. Investing in a couple of pairs of Figs is totally worth it. With the holidays right around the corner, it's a perfect time to treat yourself to some fresh looks for the new year, which is great because Figs just dropped a ton of new limited edition colors and styles for the season. If you want to check them out, Figs is offering 15% off your first purchase at wearfigs.com with the code FIGSRX. That's wearfigs.com with the code FIGSRX. Check them out today and make your life at work a little better in the new year. Hey, ACRACers, we are thrilled to have as a returning sponsor the one and only TrueLearn Smart Banks. I've used TrueLearn for my residents for years, and it is hands down the best smart bank out there. The questions are excellent, and the answers have clear explanations that break down why each choice is correct or incorrect. I love that it's customizable, so you can target weak areas or take a longer or shorter practice exam anytime. Their metrics are great, and their mobile app lets you study on the go. We use their ITE basic and advanced smart banks for our residents, each with 1,000-plus questions, realistic visuals and graphs, and even a calculator that mimics what you have on the exam. Our residents love it and get great results. TrueLearn even has a CME smart bank where you can get AMA, PRA, Category 1 credits after you finish training, and an adult cardiac anesthesiology smart bank as well. And now they have a fabulous flashcard product, which you can check out, and I highly recommend it. Go to TrueLearn.com and use code ACRAC to get $25 off residency exams, USMLE, and Comlex smart bank subscriptions of 90 days or longer, and up to 20% off other healthcare exam subscriptions. We rely on TrueLearn for our test prep, and I recommend you do the same. TrueLearn.com and use code ACCRAC. All right, and we're back with our live episode.
And the reason, as you said before, is that we get told, at least, is that it's too expensive, right? To put all these things in pre-made syringes, to switch over to a mini bag, they'd have to hire extra pharmacists, it's too expensive. And yet the alternative is that these mistakes are going to happen and we may lose practitioners because they may be so devastated by it that they leave medicine. We lose patients, and that obviously is horrible and tragic and comes with a lot of cost. So in the end, it probably makes sense to make the upfront investment in these forcing functions so that we prevent the errors from system one from happening. But how do we convince health systems to do it?
Right. Well, and I wondered, so Elliot Grigg is the one who came up with this concept. On the right side, we've done it well. On the left side, we're using totally ineffective interventions, try harder. We pretty much controlled the right side, right? We told the manufacturers what we had to have to make anesthesia safe, and they did it for us. On the left side, we don't control that. We get the medications that pharmacy buys. We get our trays the way they prepare them. And so we don't control that very well. And again, I think that perhaps the reason pharmacy gets away with saying try harder is that we're a little complicit. But before I go there, I never let them say, we don't have the money. I say, of course you have the money. You bought two surgical robots last year. Each of them costs $2 million. The service agreement on one of those robots is $150,000. Sounds like a pharmacist's salary to me. Of course you have the money. You have chosen to spend it elsewhere. But being complicit, we don't say to them, don't give me that. Of course you have the money. Because I think in our own heads, we still believe we can try harder. We kind of think that I wouldn't make the mistakes that that person made. I'm a little brighter, I'm a little smarter, and I wouldn't make that mistake. And as long as we believe that that's true, we don't push what we know we should do.
Yeah, well, we've got future leaders here right in front of us who are going to be leading our health systems, and they hopefully will have heard you talk and will make this change. I want to ask you to make a random recommendation, and then I'll do the same, and then we're going to open it up to the audience for questions. So
okay.
What would you recommend people check out?
Well, I'm a huge fan of Selena Gomez. I love her. You know, of course, she had a renal transplant. She went through significant medical issues, got her kidney transplant, and now is just doing so amazingly. So I love Only Murders in the Building.
Great show.
And then for a very short one, only 3 minutes long, 3 to 4 minutes, is John Mulvaney. There's a Horse in the Hospital. It is absolutely hilarious. He kind of starts saying, you know, we're all kind of on edge these days. We don't know what's going to happen. We're just kind of anxious and desperate. He says, I think about it like there's a horse in the hospital and nobody knows what the horse is going to do. And it just gets better and better from there. So check that one out.
Sounds great. I always at these events like to recommend something that you all can check out right here while you're in San Antonio. So I came in a little early because I gave a talk at the spa meeting Friday, and I randomly found a little restaurant that is about a half a mile down Commerce from here called Tokyo Cowboy. And it was so good. I had lunch there on Thursday, and it was so good. I went back for dinner last night. It is fabulous. It's Asian Texan fusion, small plates. Go with some friends. You can share and get a bunch of stuff. And everything we had was absolutely fabulous. Highly recommend Tokyo Cowboy down the street. All right. We're going to open it up. If you have questions for Dr. War, come on up and ask. And please introduce yourself. Let us know who you are and what your question is.
Hi, I'm Thomas. I am a resident at Washington St. Louis. Thank you so much. I'm wondering, like, as you were talking about, like, the just try harder mentality that we seem to be complicit in, to me, it feels like that starts really early in training. So, like, we're all trained in medical school to, like, take these tests that reward quick thinking and decisive, like, A, B, C, D answers. And that, for anesthesia, extends through to advanced. I'm studying for that now. And it's the same thing. I'm trying to answer these questions that are really complicated within, like, 30 seconds, if I can, so that I have enough time. And in thinking about that, I realize that I'm over-relying on my, like, fast thinking, my phase one thinking, over taking the time to really think through it. And it's successful. I'm having a lot of success in answering those questions as they're presented. But then I learn, well, I can just try harder with that and I'll get there. And it shifts us away from doing it the sort of slower way or thinking about the ways to sort of create those forcing functions. So I guess my question for you is, how early do you think this starts? And, like, how can we then try to integrate these kinds of questions and explorations earlier in the process than when you're actually practicing?
That's a really great and complex question, because when you're trying harder with those questions, I assume you mean you're going to the books and you're studying more. So what you're doing is your multiplication tables, you're putting it into mental models that you can access faster and faster because you've memorized all of them. You're still not using your deductive reasoning. And one more story around deductive reasoning, little test for you guys. System one can get in the way of your system two thinking in the same way it can present problems for perception just all by itself. So here's a question. A bat and a ball together cost $1.10. The bat costs $1 more than the ball. What does the ball cost? And I'm pretty sure the instant answer that popped into your brain really fast was 10 cents. That's wrong, because if the bat costs $1 more than the ball, then the bat costs $1.10, and together they cost $1.20. Now, your conscious brain could have done that if somebody had said, don't give me the first answer, work it through carefully, you would have gotten there. But system one, like speed, we like speed. Cognitive work takes effort. We don't like effortful. And so, again, system one intrudes on that thinking. So I don't think anybody has the answer to your question. Jerome Koopman, an internal medicine doctor, wrote How Doctors Think, talked about how do we decide what disease a patient has. And, of course, system one can tend to get in the way of that. You think that they are having X, Y, and Z, but they're not having this component. System one doesn't tell you, yes, I think that's the mental model, but they're missing this one thing. It doesn't. It just says this is the diagnosis, and it's confident of the answer. So tricks and tools that people use involve another person. This is what I'm thinking. They'll have a different system one and a different model stored, so they may come up with a different answer. And the other thing is, you know, we kind of preach this. Okay, you've got the first diagnosis. Name three other things that it could be. And force yourself to come up with a few more. And once you've got two or three others there, then you can say, oh, yeah, he's missing this one or that one. And that can help you. And then, of course, Stanford emergency manuals. So these cognitive aids to help you in those moments of stress where you have to work fast, you're really relying on system one to save a patient's life. System one is going to tell you the first mental model it comes up with, not necessarily the most accurate one. So that's where those cognitive aids, like the Stanford Emergency Manual, having that in every operating room, having it available at your fingertips, can help with that. I'm not sure how we can teach our conscious brain to be more careful and be really successful at it. We've got great tools to help us be safe.
Yeah. Right. Well, I'll add, you know, there's a fabulous, I don't know if you all listen to the Drive podcast, Peter Attia. It's a great podcast. And he recently interviewed one of the founders of Alpha School. And I recommend listening to it. I'm not going to summarize the whole thing, but Alpha School uses AI-guided teaching to bring kids who are behind grade level up very, very quickly to grade level and above. And what they have found is that for kids who are below grade level in math, the number one thing that will help is they have to get the memorization part done. So they tend to not have ever memorized their times tables, their all that stuff. And if they teach them that, which they can do pretty quickly, then they fly through a lot of the more advanced stuff. And the reason is because, this is what we've been talking about, is that if you're doing, let's say, a calculus problem, and you have to spend some of your mental energy, you use some system two energy to do what is 8 times 7, then you've got a little less of that energy left for the more complex stuff. But if 8 times 7 can be system one, then you do that. So I don't know if this applies as well in anesthesiology. I don't think it's been studied, but I do think there's probably some value in memorizing some of the stuff, not all the stuff, some of it you don't need, but some of the stuff that's on the exams, because it probably does help in the crisis to have that stuff. You don't need to look it up, so you can look up the more advanced stuff. That would be my guess.
Hi, thank you. I'm Anna Swenson, and I was just wondering, there is a movement towards standardization for making things easy and fast, like we like it. Standardization, both the kind of setup of the OR, all the anesthesia locations, as many as possible, and also kind of standardization in the anesthetics, incorporating ERAS and ORAS protocols. And I feel like that really shunts us towards the system one thinking. In this is kind of how it always is. Have you noticed any of that in your work? And then if so, how do you think we can kind of build in forces that kind of make us think about questions where in a certain situation we might need to do something different?
Yeah, thank you, Anna. Certainly, standardization, automation is considered to be a forcing function. Standardization reduces a lot of errors. If you're thinking about it, the closer bupivacaine and TXA are to each other in the medication tray, the greater the likelihood that you'll pick that up. Or if the medication tray is different every time you look at it, standardization also helps with speed, so that you can reach to one area and you know what to expect there. But it also reduces risk that you'll reach and pull out the wrong vial or the wrong ampule. And standardization of protocols, I think it was Lucien Leap who said, every physician needs to know how to write a protocol, how to use a protocol, and when to deviate from a protocol. So just because we have protocols and we've standardized things doesn't mean that we don't have to use our conscious brain along the way to say, what about this protocol doesn't fit the patient in front of me? And bring that critical thinking every time, asking yourself that question, what about this protocol isn't appropriate for this patient? And many times it's nothing, but sometimes then you'll pick something up.
And I do wonder if, you know, let's imagine the scenario where all the anesthesia trays are standardized in a given hospital, except one area. And so in that area, the Zofran has been swapped with, you know, heparin, right? Right. So in that would be terrible because you would have been trained in every area, right? Your system one just goes. You go, you pick out the Zofran, you pick out the Zofran. And then you go to that other area and you go and you're going to think it's Zofran.
Right.
Right. So I think, I would imagine that if a hospital is going to standardize, you really have to standardize. You can't just standardize some areas.
Yep. So what we did at Minnesota, Mike Wall, and I know, Anna, you might have been involved in it. There's a basic anesthesia tray that is exactly the same for everybody. Peds has still the same basic tray. It may have different concentrations, but the same meds are in the same location. And then you have the specialty tray. So you don't try to create a tray for cardiac anesthesia that has heparin and protamine in the basic tray. You keep that out in a separate, this is an add-on for just cardiac anesthesia, and the basic tray is the same in every single operating room, peds, OB, everywhere.
Yeah, that's great.
I'm Jack Wolf. I'm a fourth-year medical student. I wanted to thank you guys for this conversation, and thank you as well as someone trying to do a podcast as well in the medical space. You're an expert, and our podcast, Progress Note, looks up to you, so thank you for that. My question was a little bit more maybe looking at the neuroscientific side of things. Is there electrophysiological evidence of these two systems, one and two, and can we think of them kind of on a continuum, like two different points, or should we maybe think of them as discrete systems? That's kind of my question. Has somebody strapped sensors on someone's head making these decisions or using different systems?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the problems for this conversation that we're having now. It is really hard to understand what the subconscious is thinking and doing. No one has figured out how to tease out which part of the brain. It's throughout the brain. There isn't one part. You know, we have the limbic system, which is more for the emotions and things, and we can see it light up on a functional MRI. They haven't come up with anything that I know that can tell you this is system one, your fast, unconscious, stored, associative memories at play versus your deductive reasoning. And we may be able to tell more about deductive reasoning, I don't know, because it's effortful. And because it's effortful, you get more blood flow. So there may be some with our conscious effortful brain, but I don't know of anything in the subconscious space.
Hi, just a practical question. As somebody who has practiced for many years and has been involved in the patient safety space, just for a personal opinion, what is the biggest step we've taken in patient safety, whether it's practical, physical, like you mentioned, the PIN system, whether it's oxygen sat probes, timeouts? In your opinion, what's the biggest advance in the last 2 to 3 decades?
Again, that's a great question, and I'm not sure I can come up with an answer for that. It's like we talk about the velodrome, you know, when they race bicycles around the circuit, you know, they're almost going sideways, and somebody wants to shave 6 seconds off their time, there isn't one thing they can do to shave 6 seconds off. It's got to be six things that each take 1 second. So it's hard, depending on what the problem is, two syringes that look alike for methotrexate and vincristine, that's simple. Vincristine comes in a mini bag. The solution to that will be very different than prefilled syringes. I would say that one of the, perhaps the biggest thing that's happened in patient safety is that we're just talking about it, that we are just really now really aware of it and becoming, I hope, really conscious of the fact that it is not our fault if our system one gets in the way and creates an error. But we have to go to those forcing functions, and we have to force our leaders to bring in unique small bore connectors for neuraxial, for feeding tubes. And we have to say this is critical to our patients' safety and well-being. And maybe leave you with this that Alan Murray talks about all the time. The difference between an error, which is an unintentional failure to complete a plan of action as you wanted, and a violation, which is a conscious decision to not employ those things that experts tell you are necessary for safety. And so we often think this was an error, but you could have used this barrier, you could have had prefilled syringes, but we didn't implement it. We thought we could try harder. That actually then becomes a violation. Dr. John Eichhorn, Rob Stolting have told us what we need to do for medication safety, and yet still in our hospitals, we're missing a lot of those barriers. It's like asking me, which my favorite child, right?
I mean, it does seem, I think, to many of us who grew up with pulse oximeters, that going from not having a pulse ox to having one must have been a pretty big advancement. But I have heard people, I'm interested to hear what you think, Joyce, but people who once practiced without them who felt like, you know, you patients did okay. I mean, you paid close attention, you watched them carefully, and, you know, it wasn't like patients were dying from hypoxia left and right in the OR.
Most of them did really, really well. Having had a friend who was in anesthesia who turned the nitrous on with no oxygen, that's a rare, rare, rare event, but it is horribly devastating to everyone. And I know they say, well, we've never been able to prove that pulse oximeters help, but nobody would ever go back to doing one. So I was at UCSF. John Severinghaus had in this closet a mass spectrometer, and little tubing went up through the ceiling, you know, tubing from your elbow up down to the mass spec. And every 10 seconds, you got a refreshed, inhaled and exhaled oxygen, CO2, and inhaled gases. When I left Michigan, I'd done a year of anesthesia at Michigan, our monitor showed us EKG. Blood pressure was all manual, and there was no CO2, there was no pulse oximeter. We didn't know what our FiO2 was, which is why we could turn the nitrous up and have 100% nitrous and no alarm went off because they weren't even measuring the fraction of inspired oxygen. So having those devices, those tools, when I then had to leave UCSF and go back to giving anesthesia with nothing. Oh, and I can't tell you all the things we came up with. Well, if you feel right here when you give a breath, that's more reliable than looking at chest rise anyplace else. And all the things we tried to come up with to prevent unrecognized esophageal intubation, right? So the one thing that probably has saved more lives than anything else is CO2 in every operating room.
Yeah, fabulous. All right, I will ask one last question, which is, if someone in the audience is thinking to themselves, you know, Dr. War has had such an incredible career, she's made such an impact, I want to get involved in patient safety, what would you recommend? How can they get involved as either medical students or residents or young faculty in having a career like yours, fighting for patient safety, advocating for patient safety?
So certainly, well, now there are actual online courses that you can do in patient safety, quite a few of them, and they're very effective, and they'll give you all of the basics. But also, definitely, when the APSF newsletter comes, an Anesthesia Patient Safety Foundation newsletter comes, read it cover to cover, because it will give you a lot of the things that's happening in patient safety. And you could go back and read the seminal articles from Jeffrey Cooper, Jet Pierce, all of those great leaders. Many of them are archived on the APSF website, and it's a great thing to read an article here and there, right?
Jeffrey Cooper was one of the first live ACRAC episodes, except that was before we did it here, so it was just me and him sitting in a room live, but it was not actually on stage, so it was great to interview him, and as you said, he's done a lot.
Just a giant,
absolutely. Right. Well, thank you, Dr. War. I want to say a big thank you to Maureen Gagan and her team for making this possible, to ASA, of course, and Dr. War, to you for taking the time to be here on the show, and to our fabulous audience for taking the time to be here and your wonderful questions. So give yourselves a round of applause. And I'll end as I always do, and I really mean it, by saying that you all are, at whatever stage you're at, some of you are medical students, some of you are residents, some of you are my residents, some of you may be already in practice, but what we do is tough. You're out there, you're working hard, you don't always get a lot of gratification, a lot of thank yous for it, but I hope that you know, and I truly believe, that what you are doing every day is truly important and so very valued. Thank you for doing it. Thank you for being here, and have a wonderful rest of your conference. Thanks so much.
In cybersecurity, speed is survival. SOC Radar is your early warning system, monitoring external threats to your company to spot risks before breaches. SOC Radar delivers proactive threat intelligence with actionable insights for holistic exposure management across attack surfaces, dark web, and brand protection. With automated detection, triage, and investigation, SOC Radar is your business's frontline defense. Start your free trial at socradar.io/podcast. That's socradar.io/podcast. Don't wait.